Sometimes there's a paradigm shift in science when a visionary thinker takes accepted beliefs into unprecedented directions. In the 20th century, that thinker was maverick physicist David Bohm. Discover the groundbreaking ideas of the man Albert Einstein called his spiritual son and the Dalai Lama has named his science guru. Sign up for a free online screening of the new documentary, Infinite Potential, The Life and Times of David Bohm. You'll never look at the world the same again. Visit unityonlineradio.org/freemovie.
All are welcome. We're glad you found us. Unity Online Radio. The voice of an awakening world.
Empower yourself and get inspired to build the life of your dreams. Welcome to Everyday Peace with Dr. Drayvon James.
Welcome to Everyday Peace. I am super excited to have you here with us today while we explore the concept of living a life of peace. Everyday peace, defined as wholeness, completeness, nothing missing, nothing broken, totality. Now, I want you just to imagine right now where you are in this moment, that you're living in this bubble of everyday peace, because yes, it is possible to have peace every day. And yes, you can have peace every day. Yes, you deserve peace every single day. Wholeness, completeness, nothing missing, nothing broken, totality. And we work together here on this show to bring you the topics and the guests to partner with you as you create your life of peace every day. And right now, I want to tell you that if you have any filmmaker friends, any creative friends, if you yourself are creative, this is going to be an amazing show today. We have film director, creator, composer, editor, producer, Mr. Jack of all trades, as he calls himself, Mr. James H. Howell Jewell III. James H. Jewell III. He is a poet, rambling man, sing-songwriter, and sometimes slave to the big system. I love that, to make a buck. He and his wife, Cara, have been nomadic wanderers from their native hills of Pennsylvania. They've gone to Nashville, Los Angeles, Toronto, Paris, France, and are now in my hometown of Chicago. They have created an amazing film that we're going to be talking about today. And the other Paris, I'm excited. I'm reading this bio and I'm looking at his picture, and the whole thing gives me this, I don't want to say nostalgic, but maybe nostalgic. And I can't say nostalgic from Paris because I've only been to Paris once. But I just feel this zen-like energy because you have, James, and welcome to the show, James. Welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate it. It's so nice to be here.
It's so great to have you. And I wanted to say, you have this energy. We've talked previously and I've watched your work, this particular film, a number of times, once by myself and in the company of other crowds of people. And the whole thing is warm and cozy to me. So I'm excited to talk to you. We're going to start off with your adventure, because you say you're nomadic, and I've talked to you, and yes, you are nomadic. You're courageous. And this film is delightful. So before we get into you all together, give us a little teaser. Tell us about the film.
Well, my wife and I were at the nomadic phase of living in Los Angeles. We were there. I had a job that was manual labor, and it was good. It was good, but it was some heavy duty labor that, like, my back, I was having troubles with my back, and Cara was on leave from work, and we were struggling to kind of survive in a big city, as you know, people that live in the big city don't need any explanation about that. And she got a call from her family company, asking if she wanted to spend 3 months in Paris working for someone who was taking a break. As if you know anything about the French culture, it's perfectly acceptable to take 3 months off from work at any time, almost. It's not like in the U.S. So she was taking a sabbatical, this person, and Cara was invited to do it. And she looked at me and said, "You wouldn't want to move to Paris, would you?" And I remember my back was hurting that day, I thought to myself, "Yeah, let's go." So we went, and it turned into 6 months, which turned into 8 years. And I had been doing some documentary work and some other film work, but I was mostly writing and playing music while I was in Paris. But when it came time to go, my wife was really determined to make a documentary about our experience there. And I said, "Well, it's now or never." So we kind of knew only about 2 months in advance. And I actually stayed longer. Cara moved to Chicago, and I actually stayed longer. And I just filmed everything I could. And anyone who was willing to sign a release form and talk to me. And then we came back here with all the footage and edited it. So I don't know if that answers your question. That's the short answer.
Yes, the short answer, because we're going to get into a whole lot of detail about Some Other Paris, the film, because it is an amazing film. And I encourage everyone, you can watch it on YouTube. It is amazing. I think it does, for me, what it did for a lot of the people that I watched it with, is it opened us up to beauty in the time of this uncertainty that there was this, the world is bigger than just our little pocket of problems, right? And so you open up a little bit and you get to see and experience the world through other people, and to know that you and your wife had the courage to hop on a plane. You're living in LA. Now I got to ask you, I know your wife, you said your wife had family over there. So she spoke French?
No, her family business, and this is actually kind of an interesting topic, because her family business is a dessert company here in the U.S., but they sell worldwide. So when we tell people that, so she went over to expand the company in France, and the joke is that, why are you bringing desserts to the French? don't they know how to make their own desserts? I mean, they're famous for their food. So basically, they have people in France developing their business, and that's what she went over there for. So she didn't have anybody in her family other than the fact that her father has spent a lot of time in Paris and loves Paris. So she immediately, when we were in LA and she got the job, she took serious French lessons for 2 months, and I mean it was grueling. And then she went over there, and she said, and then she when she arrived in Paris, she still felt like she could barely speak anything. And then it took her quite a while. And now she is conversational in French, whereas I can, you know, I mean, I can order a croissant and an omelet, but, you know, my French is terrible.
Wow. Now, I've been in France a very, very small period of time. I took French in high school. That doesn't really count. But I remember being able to read a little bit here and there, but we did encounter in our short time there people who did not speak English. Did you encounter that a lot while you were there?
We did. And, you know, I found that for me personally, I learned some polite phrases and how to kind of order and how to kind of get by in French. So I had enough French to get by in. And as long as I went in, the big thing about the French, this is a trick out there for anybody who is going to go to France. As long as you can say hello, thank you, and goodbye in French, you're going to be ahead of the game. Because if you walk into a place and say bonjour, you are way ahead of the game. They appreciate it so much if you say, and then if you say thank you, they just appreciate it, and they'll cut you a break much easier. If you don't speak French, if you at least say hello, good day, and thank you. So I learned that early. And then I also, if I went into a place that didn't speak French, I kind of faked it, and I knew enough to get by. and I enjoyed kind of submerging myself into cafes and stuff where they didn't speak any English, but I could also find cafes where they were actually kind of excited to speak some English and practice their English. So depending on the day, and I you know, after living there 8 years, you know which places you can go to where they won't give you a dirty look about not speaking French. But yeah, they're very funny about that. I mean, we had a plumber come over, and he gave me so much grief about not speaking French, and I was like, oh, just fix my plumbing.
Well, we Americans can do that.
Absolutely.
Speak the language. So, you know, and I did tell my kids, we had our little tour book. We were doing the best that we can. We had a great time, and people were very, very kind to us. But, you don't hear that. I think if you follow the stereotypes, they tell you that France is one of the most difficult places because they're not tolerant of people who don't speak the language. But I definitely did not find that to be so. But I really want to talk to you about this. Since, you know, when I spoke to you the first time, the thing I told you that really stuck out for me is that this sense of adventure and the idea, the concept that if you want to learn how to swim, you're going to have to get wet. And I love that about, you know, here you are in LA. I mean, it's one thing to move from, you know, Pennsylvania to Nashville, right? It's quite another thing to pick up and say, yep, moving to Paris tomorrow.
Right. And so, you know, if you think too much about it, it's going to be difficult. And I mean, I don't want to give too much credit to our bravery or our sense of adventure, although I think we do have that. I also think that we have a sort of, I don't know, a blind faith or something like that, we kind of like jump in, you know, before, without looking sometimes. So, I mean, I also think it's sometimes I think we're just, I don't know what the word is to use. I don't want to say foolhardy, but we're just like, okay, let's do this. And we don't really think, like, we found out a whole bunch of stuff about how difficult it was going to be, especially getting our visas and all of that, that may have slowed us down if we had known about them. So sometimes it's good not to know too much before you leap.
I agree with that. You could research yourself right into staying in the same position that you're in literally for the rest of your life. If you look at all
that's
of the
good way
details,
of putting it.
You know, if you look at all of the details and you think you try to get every step figured out, you really will paralyze yourself saying, you know, there's no way I could do it. I have this part of my brain which is very linear, like I really want things in order. And I try to silence that part of my brain as much as possible because I realize that's when I get stuck. That's when I'm looking for so much detail. And there's the other side of my brain that's saying, if you don't just jump in the pool already, you know, get going, I'll get you where you need to go. I just need you to get in the pool. So I applaud you guys for getting in the pool, and you get over into Paris. Your wife starts working with an American dessert company selling desserts in Paris. And I don't, you know, I know that my kids and I were in Paris. The desserts looked so, so good, but they didn't have even 50% of the sugar content that my kids were accustomed to. They were like, oh, yeah. So I don't know if they had to adjust that recipe and get that sugar down.
Well, you know, I think this is why American desserts are popular over there. Because, you know, they're the chocolate chip cookie, the apple pie, the cheesecake even, carrot cake, which they, they had to go to carrot cake school to learn how to eat that because they were like, this makes no sense to have carrots in a cake. This is not right. And as soon as they tasted it, they were like, ooh la la, this is amazing. So it was the American desserts that were different, that stuck out. I think that's why they were easy to sell over there, is because nothing like apple pie. Nothing like a piece of apple pie, you know. So
we do.
But yeah,
we do, We do desserts justice here. They do presentation beautifully there, though. So you get there, and you're there these whole 8 years. You know, 6 months turns into 8 years. And during those 8 years, and you're meeting all these creative people in the film, and we're going to get to that part shortly. But during the eight-year process, were you thinking, well, we need to get together and start putting a movie together, start doing a documentary on this time period? I mean, I know, of course, you didn't know you'd be there 8 years, but even on a three-month junket into Paris, being a filmmaker, being, you know, having the background that you both had, was that part of your thought? Well, we'll make a film out of our experience there.
It actually was not. What happened was when we were in Los Angeles, we filmed a web series, and I was working for – when I was in the U.S., I had a small business making commercials, video commercials for corporations. So it wasn't like things that you would see on YouTube or on, you know, I would do product videos or I would do videos. So I learned how to make films. I learned how to make videos. And I learned about the gear and I learned how to edit. And then when we moved, so I was kind of getting good at that before we moved to Paris. But when we moved to Paris, I have to say, I was inspired to write and play music, especially writing, because there's a huge writing community there, and they're very supportive. So I was able to, you know, one of my dreams was to write a novel, another was to write some poetry. I was able to do that pretty much like within the first couple of years because the community around me, they were just like, what do you mean you want to write something? Just do it. Come back next week. We want to see four poems. Come on. You know, so I was like, okay. And so the encouragement and the community, I mean, you can't underscore the importance of community for an artist or for somebody who's being creative because, you know, unto yourself, it is you need encouragement. I know that I can speak for myself. All of my insecurities, I don't know if that's natural in artists in general, but many artists have this insecurity, maybe because their mind is open and sensitive and, or whatever. The community there really encouraged me to do that. And then when we found out we were leaving, we had all of this camera equipment that we brought with us from Los Angeles, and we hadn't done a whole lot with it. We had done a little bit with it, but then I was like, we were heartbroken to leave, and we were like, well, what are we going to do in honor of this 8 year? What can we do to encapsulate it? And Cara had been wanting to do the documentary, and so I was like, that's the answer. So we're going to, and to be quite frank, I was intimidated by the idea of making my, you know, our first feature length film. So I was like, you know what, we're going to film it and we're going to film for 2 months. And if it seems like we're going to put it together and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, but we're going to give it a try. So it was a little bit like, again, it was sort of like the decision to move to Paris. We're like, you know, we're going to give it a try. We're not going to place the world, you know, the weight of the world on it. And if it comes together, then it comes together. And when we got back to the U.S., we actually needed to film some more, and we just called our friends in Paris and had them do some filming for us and send us the footage. So, it was very. Seat of the pants is, I don't know the term. I was very last minute, yeah. But we're very happy with the outcome.
Yeah, and I would say that there is no part of the film that screams first feature length film. Not, I mean, it's just beautifully flows.
That's so
nice
to hear.
You're welcome. It's really a well-deserved compliment because it is entertaining to the very end. and every person that you talked with and every response, you just really captured their enthusiasm. And there were a lot of interesting things. I don't want to give too much away about the film. I want people to really, really watch the film. You will explore, you'll get to explore some wonderful parts about Paris, but I think some of the talking just made, in the way that it was filmed and the discussions as they flowed, opened up ideas about my own life, my own thought patterns about the country that I'm so privileged to live in and call home.
Yep.
And that became, and we'll talk about that probably in the next segment of this show, but that was part of the focus point of people that watched the film with me. It made them feel some, you know, spark some conversation. But I want to go to this point about the importance of community, because I do believe that it, our worlds, whether you're living in a creative world, we're always creating, whether your world is the arts, you're creating that way, or you're creating at home with children, or you're creating in corporate America or in the healthcare field, we're always creating. But that comment that you made about the importance of community, and community does challenge us. I heard you say, they would say, what do you mean you want to write? Go home, come back next week with four poems. And that, and as an artist myself, that's this creative challenge, right? So we get this challenge. And for those who are listeners who are listening today who may not be in the arts necessarily, I want to tell you what that looks like. That, those are challenges that show up in our everyday life, right? That's the car breaking down, or a new project at work when you don't have a big enough team to take it on. And you being, having this community around you that says, I believe you can do it, because guess what? Your job may depend on you getting it done, or your family's, you know. So, but this is what happens, and it's sort of like they say, art imitates life, or life imitates art. But there's one big circle that we can learn from, is that challenges are meant to encourage us. They're meant to encourage us to go to the next level. And if you can get some real live people on your team just to listen to you, at one point in your film where you have, where they are holding the readings in the bookstore there. And I love to do readings as an artist, you know, to do those readings. But I really felt a sense of community, and life is better if you can do it with at least one other person. It doesn't have to be intimate, but just somebody that you can bounce your ideas off of. So I got that from the film, and I get that from this conversation that we're having today, you know, talking about some other Paris, but it could be some other any place really to me. That's how open the film was. I know you talked a lot about Paris, and we have a few minutes so before the break. I want to make sure that we don't hit that break, and I don't want to stop an important in midst of an important discussion. But there was a point in the film where you were speaking to all of these different people, and you asked this one question that was very, very intimidating to me, but how many languages do you speak? And only people were rattling off so many languages, which I found that in Europe, they speak a lot of languages.
Yeah. I mean, you know, since I really only speak English, it was so inspiring to me. And I started taking, I took 2 months of French right at the end before we found out we were moving to Chicago. And I only took 1 month. It was a 2 month course, and I cut it short because we were moving. So, but I took 1 month of 5 days a week, 4 hours a day. And I just, after the end of the month, I finally started to learn some French. But the thing that blew me away was how many languages they spoke, and how it wasn't a big deal that they spoke those languages. Four and a half, and you know, and I read Mandarin or something. It's like, okay. You know, it was so inspiring. That was such an inspiring question for me to ask as an American. A lot of them over there were like, well, why are you asking this? Everybody speaks a bunch of languages. I mean, that's just the way. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. You know, this is such a cool, it's kind of a cool milestone question of the difference between people from the U.S. and people from Europe. Of course, they live next to each other and speak different languages, so that helps. But, you know, you're only like 50 miles away from somebody who speaks Dutch or you know, 100 miles from someone who speaks a different language. So that does encourage you. You might have an aunt or uncle who speaks a different language, or even a family member. So that does help people to learn other languages. So they have an unfair advantage, but that was impressive. Yeah.
Yeah, that was very, very, very impressive. And another thing maybe we can touch on just before we go to break is it was blatantly put out there. Like, a lot of people had a strong desire to be in Paris, you know, that came across really strong in the film, and that they, you know, Paris is a lot of things, as you point out in the film, and as I found from my experience, it, one thing it is not is cheap. I found it to be right. Very expensive. Paris is very, yep. Very expensive. And, yep. You know, we talked about gas prices. I think we talked about that before we came on the show.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll go into about the protests and that in a bit. But it is expensive to be there. That being the case, people not being able to get work visas and all this, what is the pull for so many people to have this strong desire? What do you think it is? Why is it that,
you know,
without a job, they want to be in Paris?
I have an answer. Yeah, I have an answer for that. I don't know if it's I have a theory about that, which is basically there is a community in Paris. And I think it has an expat community in particular. And I think it might have to do with the fact that the expat community is smaller, and it's just historically there to be an artist, a painter, a theater writer, a writer, a performer. And so that when you get over there, it's just, I think it's a history of people being creative and supporting creative people. But on top of that, because it's an expat community, it's a small community within Paris. So you have the large city, but then you have the expat community. And so it's a small, tight-knit community.
Okay, we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about why Paris. We were talking some other Paris with our filmmaker, James Jewell, today.
You're listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Create and build the life of your dreams. Welcome back to Everyday Peace with Dr. Drayvon James.
Welcome back to Everyday Peace with Dr. Drayvon James and our fabulous guest today. We have filmmaker James Jewell with us today. We're discussing his new film, Some Other Paris, an amazing film. And guess what? You can see it on YouTube, the entire film. I encourage you, pop your own popcorn, sit back, relax, be swept away, go to Paris for a day, and just really enjoy the film. Before we went to break, we were talking about why, and you'll get this in the film if you watch it, why so many people, especially creative types who are in the arts, just long to be in Paris no matter what. That's where they want to go. And you were just in the middle of telling us why they just have to be there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a mystery, but I mean, if I had my theory, as I was saying before, was that you have the small community of the expat artistic community inside of a large city with all of the pluses and struggles of a big city, so that you have the small community, which is less intimidating and very encouraging. And they are just determined to produce their art no matter what, they don't really think too much about the industry of it. So to compare it with Los Angeles for sure would be that Los Angeles is about the industry, as a filmmaking industry, as a music industry, whereas Paris, they have a little bit, and France in general, has a little bit of an anti-industry feel about it, where it's like you go, you write some poetry, and you go out on a Saturday night, and you read it to 25 or 30 of your friends in a cafe, and you sit there afterwards, and you have a couple of drinks and a coffee, and you just tell each other how great it was to hear them read their poetry, and you don't think about, am I going to make any money on this? You just are so grateful that these people were listening to your expressions and not judging, you know. I mean, although, don't get me wrong, there are times of judgment, and there is, you know, there's some moments where people have disagreements, especially on the content of their poetry. And then slam poetry is a huge community over there too. So I don't know if that explains it, but that is definitely something that I miss. Like, even when our friends, we had a friend come to Chicago when we first moved here, and she said, you know, people are like, oh, that's great. So you're a musician. So what are you doing with it? Are you making a record? When are you going to sell your record? How much do you think you're going to make? Are you going to make a living? And in Paris, that's just not, that's not part of the conversation. The conversation is, are you developing your art? Are you making your art? And also, I don't know how much it has to do with the fact that they have socialized medicine, so nobody has to worry about health insurance in France.
Right. And I get that. And it sounds like to me when you were talking about, you know, the commitment to the art, it sounds a lot like, and I'm in the Maryland, Baltimore area, community theater. Whereas right. Community theater is a place where, you know, not all of its expression, but is most concerned with not making the big bucks, but really having this authentic voice of the artist.
Right.
And that's what kind of I got from the film, is that this is a voice, you have something burning inside of you that you want another human with a heartbeat to hear. And not so much for them to agree or disagree, but just the hearing of your, or the viewing of your craft, just having it land on another person's ears or having them view it is validation enough. They could sit there and rip it apart, but just that you get it out into the world is validating. And maybe to do it in such a well-established place as Paris, because when you think about Paris,
community theater, I think, is a very good example of what we're talking about. And I think that's because nobody goes into community theater thinking that they're going to get rich, thinking that they're going to make money. And I think that, like, with music and with novel writing and with, you know, with music and with writing and with some other types of art, there is an opportunity to make money, and there are some people who have gotten very rich, so that you have that in the back of your mind. But community theater, I know that I was involved in some theater, and it's just not there, because they just know that that's not what it's all about. So it's, you kind of give into that, and you're like, I'm doing this out of love, and I'm not doing this. So I think that, you know, that's a really good example of, but in Paris, for sure, I think they have more of that view across the creative arts, where it's like, as long as you're making it, you don't have to think further than that. As long as you're making it and revising it and working on it and improving it, you know, that's what it's all about. If somebody picks it up, or if you get published and make some money, that's great, but that's not what it's all about. I still have that problem. I mean, I'm still looking for ways to make a couple dollars with my art, but you know, obviously you have to, as soon as you start doing that, you have to start looking at, okay, what will sell, and then that affects what you're making. So
Right. And I get that, because here in the States, and being the only place I ever really lived and worked, it is frowned upon, at least in lots of segments of our population, it is frowned upon that you would decide to be a starving artist, and it's irresponsible, considered to be irresponsible. You know, you are really supposed to be this productive member contributing to the tax system, right? And but the arts contribute in such a phenomenal way. We all know that. A lot of times we want to make great references to something. We use the arts to do that. So we know that they do contribute. But I see, you know, through the film that there is almost a reverence for people who make this decision that they are going to commit to their art in such a way. Now, and I do believe what you said, socialized medicine probably plays a big part, and that three months off that you can get, you said that earlier in the show, that you can get 3 months off your job. So basically, if you can get some roommates, or if you got someone who can help you finance your bills, your job is secure. You can take 3 months off and write or explore your craft. Here in the United States, you can get probably 2 weeks strung together. And after that, you got to get back to the grind. So there's a difference. We do have a caller on the lines. I want to just pick our caller up here.
Oh, excellent.
And let's see here. Hello, welcome to Everyday Peace with Dr. Drayvon James and our fabulous guest today, James Jewell. How are you today?
I'm great. How are you? Another great show, Dr. James.
Oh,
I'm loving it. So I have a question. Usually the questions I ask relate to improvement and all sorts of stuff, because you have great guests. But my question today is, since you have a filmmaker who has worked in Europe, I'm always curious as to why, and at least it appears to me and other people, that European television, particularly British television, is so much better than American television. I was wondering if your guest has had people ask him questions like that, or if he thinks that that's the case. I certainly think that's the case. I just want to listen to what his answer is.
That's a great question.
Yeah, I definitely have felt that way. Now, I don't know if that's changing, and that there's that British television and French television, I'm not as sure about, because I don't speak French. But I think that there's less channels, and that some of them are like the BBC, it's the national television channel, and they have stricter rules about what can be put out there and what can't be. And I think that because there's less of it, the standards I think have to be higher in order to. But I'm not 100% sure why that is. But I felt the same way as you do.
Okay, yeah, great. I was just wondering, the acting seems so much better, and I was just wondering what you thought, being that this is your genre, the arts. And so you and Dr. James have a lot in common in regards to that. So I was just wondering. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being an everyday peacemaker. You know what show comes to my mind? Downton Abbey. I don't think I've seen a better show on television. I was so sad when that show went off. So, but thank you again, and thank you for being an everyday peacemaker. Enjoy your day. So I hear that a lot from people too, that maybe because they don't have as many shows, they're not as rushed to put out product as, and maybe they don't consume as much product as we do here, whereas, you know, we're 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We're looking for something new and coming out rapidly, and the series are pretty short. So maybe they don't have all of those handicaps there. But I do hear that people really enjoy the television shows and the movies and stuff that come out from there. And one thing I did see in the show, too, and we're going to talk about this, is in your movie, you talked a lot about the political situation that's going over there. And I guess the riot, or the protest, if you will, started out over just gas prices initially. Was that what it was?
Right. Yeah. So it was raising the gas prices across the board to create more income for the, you know, for the government to do its programs. And the problem with the gas tax was that, in just like, you know, I think in the U.S., it affected people who could not afford it. So instead of, you know, instead of taxing people according to what they could afford, they just went across the, you know, it was a gas tax. So anybody who got out onto the road and had to work for a living and was barely able, you know, I think that low hourly wages, it's way different here than it is in France, but they're struggling with that too. So struggling to pay their bills. And then when they get this, when the government forces gas prices to go up because of the gas tax, the French just said, no, this isn't going to happen. And so they began these massive protests. I think there was over 100,000 protests across France, in different [S2] Wow. [S1] Towns, that basically were united. And within a few weeks, now I might be getting this wrong, but within a certain period of time, Macron said, okay, I'm taking the tax away. No more tax.
Yeah.
So,
and I don't know the period of time, but yeah, it did go away. Yeah.
And then they continued with just a general, a general unfairness in wages and a general unfairness in the price of day-to-day living and everything else that was increasing people struggling to just pay groceries day-to-day and to live day-to-day, just like we're struggling with here. So then that continued with a much longer list of complaints.
Yes.
And then mixed in with that, there were, some people say there were some bad eggs, sort of like the riot, sort of like the looters here that were going along with the protests just to do some looting and to cause trouble. So then there was that whole dynamic as well. But
I saw that throughout the film, and one thing that I appreciated was how, you know, they say rioting is the language of the unheard, right? Because, you know, unseen and unheard, because there's a group of people who are unseen and unheard until they cause some disruption in the main
right.
system. And so they did that, and I was really amazed with how effective it was. I mean, the tax was taken away, and so a lot of people that I watched the film with, both different sets of my friends, ones from the healthcare community and then others from the arts, creative arts community, and both sets picked up on the same thing, that here when the protest started out and it had a direct aim, this is what we want. We want you to repeal
yep.
this tax, and then we'll go back to peace. We all know that didn't happen.
Yep.
It was very clear. The objective was very, very clear, and they got the results. And so, you know, started comparing it to what we have going on here and looking for, and I'm sure you probably had this discussion with other people who've watched it, looking for clear objectives when you're protesting.
Yep.
So that was one thing that we saw then. But then we also, I had people mention in, you sort of mentioned it too here, when the protests continued beyond that, I wondered if the government then said, this is what you get when you give in to anarchy, right? Because we've shown that it can change, anarchy can produce change, but now we just got, you know, believing that, oh, now we're going to change everything by using this force. Every time we don't get what we want, we're going to use this type of force to get it. And now the objective doesn't really seem to be that clear. That came across to me in the film, too, that people just really weren't clear on what the objective is now for the protesting.
Right, right. Yeah, I must admit, there are gaps in my understanding, especially because I don't speak French. There were some gaps, and that was what was so interesting to hear from different people. And I mean, there were those, as you saw in the film, that said, you know, Now it just seems like a waste of time, and people just like to break things, and it's just, you know, it's just fun for them to go out and do. And then other people were like, no, this is a true expression of their feelings, and you know, they're going to be heard, and it's even if it's not clear, you know, like the rabbi said, you know, it's time for, you know, it's time for the people that are in power to recognize that, you know, they have the people to reckon with, and that they need to be more fair. Now, yeah, it does get muddled at one hand, and some people say, well, that's just the nature of it, but that doesn't mean you should stop. You should get in the way of the protest. So yeah, there's gray area. I'm not sure where I stand on that. Definitely there's a point where it becomes simply destructive. When we have governments in place that have destructive tendencies, then, you know, destruction, I guess, begets destruction. I don't know. It's a tough subject.
But what I think you did really well in the film is really showing how there was this tolerance and a freedom of being able to say, I don't understand. I'm not clear on the objective, but I understand the need to protest. And I thought that was lovely that came across in the film, that people really did admit that I'm not really sure what the objective is now, but I understand the need. And
right.
That touched such a human part. It's like I understand there, you know, someone talked about how technology had overtaken the jobs and there were no jobs. And so even though you don't really know what's going to come out of the protest, you understand the need for the person to be heard, to be seen.
Right. So expressing an expression of pain and anger. Expressing it. Yeah.
And I got that throughout the whole film. I got that throughout the entire film, that the people that you interviewed, this creative group community, was the acceptance of the full rainbow of emotions. And, you know, someone said, you come to Paris to suffer. And I thought, well, how romantic is that? And you may say the same thing about New York until you actually have to do it. Right.
Right.
And then, but it's just beautiful that to know that, you know, this acceptance of the whole array of emotions is possible. And we can take all this in the journey. Now, what is the one, or maybe there's more than one, takeaway that you want the audience to get from Some Other Paris?
You know, I think that what I attempted to do was allow people to speak for themselves, and get enough people and enough diversity of people speaking that the viewer of the movie could come up with their own final decision. So rather than, now I know it's impossible to make a film completely unbiased. I mean, most of these people were my friends. So, you know, there's a whole, there's many other sides to Paris, and maybe that's why I called it Some Other Paris, because it's one side of Paris, because there's many different levels going on. You know, there's the trouble with there's the immigrant population and their struggle there, and there is, you know, there's the class struggle and stuff like that, which I didn't touch on a whole lot. But what I really wanted to do was portray Paris in such a way that the viewer could come away with their own decision as to what Paris was and whether or not it'd be something that they would want to go experience for themselves, or just learn, you know, I guess just learn, just open people's eyes to something other than the Champs-Élysées and the shops and the croissants and the in the fashion industry, something else, you know, see another side of Paris. So
I think you did that very well too, because that's really what I did when I went. But I think you did that very, very well to ought to show us the other parts of Paris, the heart, maybe even the underbelly, if you will, of Paris. It's just, this was really the soul of people who were in there day to day. And I happened, when you said that, thought about the man who said that he wanted to encourage you one day, and he said, well, you know, you come to Paris to suffer. And then he said, he's laughing when he says it. But then someone else mentions about how gray it can be in Paris. Sometimes, you know, the sky can be really gray in color, and how you can find beauty in anything. And that, I think, will come across very, very strong in the film as well, is that the situation in itself doesn't need to be beautiful for you to find beautiful in it. And
that's beautiful.
That was what, yeah, I
that's a beautiful way of putting it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm so.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm so appreciative of your take on the film, because you know, somebody can say, "Oh, it's a great film. I liked it," but all of the things that you're saying are really why I made the film. So it's so encouraging to hear this interview's been, it's just so inspiring, because I feel like somebody got it. I mean, believe me, I've gotten a lot of great reviews and comments about the film, but I'm just so happy that, you appreciate it, and you appreciate all the nuances of it, because that makes me feel like Kara and I, we accomplished what we wanted to. So it's very encouraging to hear.
Amazing filmmakers. And I wanted to say for our listening audience too, that this is the type of film, if you're having a great day, watch this film. You're going to have even a better day. But if you're having one of those days where you're just questioning, like, why to everything, you know, we have those days, you know, what is going on? Why am I here, God? Watch this film, and it will, I guarantee you, you'll be able to sit in your situation, in your chaos, in your disappointment, and you'll be able to smile, because you'll be able to see that, yeah, there is beauty in the gray sky. There is beauty in the, and we didn't talk about this, but, you know, this not being able to totally fit into your society, because that was a theme that came up a lot in the film, was people saying, you know, I really don't, I've been here for a while, and I feel like I'm still on the outside, and in the periphery of this thing, and I like it. I like it.
Right.
I like to be,
right.
You know, and so in our lives, and I know we're running out of time, but I really want to tie this into those of us who are not filmmakers, or those people who are not filmmakers. It's okay to feel as though you're running on the outside of things, and you're not 100% in on the mainstream. There's beauty in that experience too. And I know that in everything, you can find a message for you to cling on to. So if you're having that experience, and right now during this pandemic, I'm hearing that from people feeling like, you know, well, I don't really know. I'm so unsure. I'm so uncomfortable with uncertainty. This film will help you to find beauty in uncertainty, beauty in being what we call the misfit, right? And just being on the outside of things. I'm so grateful to you, James, for making this film, and for you guys saying yes to 3 months, yes, 8 years in Paris, and just starting to take your first French class on the last 2 months of your journey. Because it all speaks.
Well, I thought that was going to, you know, at that point, I thought, okay, we're here 8 years. We're probably going to be here the rest of our life. And then 4 months later, we're in Chicago. So.
You're in Chicago, and you're open to it, and you're open to it. So this is Everyday Peace with Dr. Drayvon James. We've had a wonderful time today talking with James Jewell and his wonderful film, Some Other Paris. For Everyday Peacemakers, we make every day full of wholeness, full of peace. We accept what is, and we become creative in our own way. I thank you so much for showing up today as an Everyday Peacemaker. I absolutely love you.
Been listening to Everyday Peace with Dr. Drayvon James. You have the power right now, today, to make the decisions, to take the actions that lead you to your next level of greatness. And I would love to walk with you on your journey. Here's some ways we can connect. Schedule a coaching session. Contact me at info@drdravonjames.com. Enroll in my online university course, the 2020 Clarity Course, at the Institute for Leadership and Lifelong Learning International. Enroll in the Brilliant Life 9-week online coaching session with me and Keisha Dixon at info@drdravonjames.com. Purchase my book, Freedom is Your Birthright, from Amazon. Thank you for being an everyday peacemaker. I absolutely love you.
Thanks for listening. This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world. Sometimes there's a paradigm shift in science when a visionary thinker takes accepted beliefs into unprecedented directions. In the 20th century, that thinker was maverick physicist David Bohm. Discover the groundbreaking ideas of the man Albert Einstein called his spiritual son, and the Dalai Lama has named his science guru. Sign up for a free online screening of the new documentary, Infinite Potential, The Life and Times of David Bohm. You'll never look at the world the same again. Visit unityonlineradio.org/freemovie.